Colonel Collins, Reel 8. Now, what was the ground like for patrolling? It must have been very different from the valley area you'd been working in.
It was like scree, a lot of it, very, very rough and broken ground. Some vegetation on it. I mean, the people there tried to cultivate it in some way. You know, I forget the precise details, I just got the general picture of the topography. But, you know, it was very steep and broken ground. I thought it was a mountainous area.
Could you locate the German positions?
I don't remember. I don't remember so doing. I don't remember the details of the patrol. The only thing I can remember is how lucky I was to get back in one piece.
Now, what's the next thing you remember of this time?
Well, I remember then, of course, the accounts of the various actions that were going on. One could see a certain amount of the attacks going forward. I can't remember in what sequence now, but a number of attacks were put in to go up through a defile, up through the Cannabrito Basin, which is on the face of the mountain, facing in our direction. And there was a spur sticking out towards us called the Cocorito Spur. And eventually came the time, the 16th Battalion, you know, to our brigade, to go in and... Not our battalion, I said, but our brigade to go in. And I seem to remember that George Balance, who was then commanding a rifle company, as I recall, or was he second in command, I'm not absolutely sure, but he was, I think, loaned or temporarily to another unit who were doing that attack, and he took a part of his force, whether it was a company or something like that, to bolster that attack. And sad to say, he was killed. And that made a tremendous... he was so well-known and so popular and such a marvelous officer. And oddly enough, we've got a friend now we met many, many, many years since who knew him when he was a young schoolmaster. That made a very, very sad impact on the battalion. We were all shaken by it. Although there were casualties all the time, but someone, you know, so well loved and so senior as that. Anyway, so then the word was getting around, and one could see the CO and the brigadier was there, and various plans were being made. The word was getting around that rather than pressing on through this route that seemed doomed to failure because the enemy was so well deployed above it, but that we were going to, and I think it was kind of Johnny Preston's plan, certainly he got the credit for it with us, and I think. We deserved it, was that we would make a long night approach. We would go by night around another defile up the mountainside, around to the east, as I recall, and that we would travel all night and go up and climb to the top of the mountain by around the flank, the right flank, and then come down on the enemy from the top. And we did that.
What do you remember of the night, Bart?
I remember it was like climbing. I mean, the nearest thing was when I walked up Snowdon, later years. There was very steep tracks, and of course we were carrying full battle order, and 48 hours rations or something like that, and full battle water bottles, and full load of ammunition, and there was no possibility of any sort of motor transport going on there, and so we had mules, pack mules, that took the heavy stores up. And I can just remember going up this winding track all through the night with periodic, breaks of 5 or 10 minutes each hour and so on, and with the mules going along beside us and going up as quietly as we could. And there was a guards division or a guards brigade, I think, on our to the east of us, on our other flank. And so by the morning, we got up onto the...
Unobserved.
Unobserved, yes. As far as I know. Bear in mind, I was a platoon commander, and one of the things that often struck me since is even reading the accounts of company commanders' experiences. From my point of view, I mean, they were sort of some way behind, and they were in closer touch with battalion headquarters. They had a wireless set on the battalion net. They knew what was going on, obviously from the paid information, but so far as I know, I don't know the point of, the Germans were certainly still there when we got there anyway.
What happened then when you got there?
Well, we got there and we got to, you know, there was a sort of relatively flatter ground, but it was rather more sort of rolling hills than it might be, say, up on Bodmin Moor with Tor and things like that. And we were given an axis of advance. I forget which particular objective we were, that's been given some sort of an objective. A Company was being commanded by Ray Mitchell at that time, and we were going across, because we were going at an angle, a more westerly direction from our line of advance up around the right flank, as you can imagine. And what I strongly recollect then, that as we were going across there, we came under a lot of small arms fire and a lot of artillery fire. In fact, the artillery fire was extremely confusing. We were never very sure. It was all so close to us. And we were never very sure if it was a German defensive fire or our own barrage, you know, supporting us. Because the shells seemed to be falling all around. But the most conspicuous thing was the small arms fire, and we suffered a lot of casualties. And they kind of seemed to be coming from one particular location. I think there were altogether some, I think about 18 men in A Company in the space of about half an hour were hit individually with bullets. Just digressing for a moment, this is where the medical officer had done a tremendous job. He brought his regimental aid post up that track with us, and he'd set up a regimental aid post in a sort of crofter's hut down on the sort of lee side of the mountain. And these casualties were taken down to them and down to him. And anyway, so we were under this fire, and then I spotted where it was coming from. And of course, everybody we were keeping pretty close to the ground because anything that moved, you know, was fired at. And do you want me to go on this story?
Yes.
Because I had a very big personal involvement there. We were sort of cowering behind. There were boulders and things there, and perhaps, you know, very low, dry stone walls and that sort of thing. And let's say, 80 yards to 50 to 100 yards, anyway, on our right then, as we were going across. We were going across from right to left. This was on our right, as you would expect. There was a lot of fire was coming from there. And I was so incensed, really. I was very angry that some of my chaps were being hit. And in particular, one very nice lad called Baglin, Private Baglin. Incidentally, he was the only one of that lot who died subsequently. And I had correspondence, he was unmarried, and I had correspondence afterwards. Very harrowing stuff, you know, with his sister and so on. But anyway, Jimmy Baglin, he was hit. So Ray Mitchell was there, really wondering quite what to do, I think. And I said, well, look, I'll go again and sort it out. You know, will you let me go? And he said, well, you know, if you want to, sooner you than me, sort of thing. And I said, well, I'll take a little assault party around to the right flank. And he said, well, all right, well, good luck. So I set up a machine gun post to fire back at these people, keep their heads down while I moved with two or three chaps. Now, Phillips, my batman, I'm pretty sure he was one of them. Corporal Clayton, I well remember, he was another. I hand-picked about three or four men. And we went around the right flank. And one thing I've had nightmares about since was that I don't remember what order I gave them as to how they would know when to stop firing when I went in to rush the building. And I don't really think that I gave any order about that. I don't think I fired a signal. I may have done.
For the machine gun to stop the covering fire.
To stop the covering fire, absolutely. So anyway, and of course I wanted to get on with it, so I went, possibly you might say impetuously, but anyway, straight forward. And I well remember as I ran into the target area where our machine gun was still firing rapid fire, and the bullets were you know, cracking over my head. And but I think they saw it just in time. And when I got around the side of the building, I saw that there was no entrance to it on the ground floor, but there was an outside staircase. And so I rushed straight up that staircase, and there was a door open at the top. And of course, I was aware of the danger of going into an open doorway. So somehow or another, I don't know whether I don't remember throwing a grenade in. I don't think I took time for that. But somehow I established that there was nobody in that upper room. And then I looked over the sort of parapet where I was standing at the top of this stairway, and down behind was an extension to the farm building, like a cattle shed or something like that. And it was clear then to me that the enemy were all in there. And of course I was standing about 8 or 10 feet above them. So I opened up with my Tommy gun down through the slates of the roof or the tiles, whatever they were. And of course they were absolutely, and my other chap, I ordered them around the side of the staircase to my left, you see. So there they were, standing outside the door with their rifles in there at the ready. And I was standing up above, firing down on this thing. So of course, I mean, what came out through the door was a white flag on the end of a rifle bayonet. There was absolutely nothing else I could do. So we got them, so we you know, then called the thing off and shouted them to come out. With their hands up, and they came out. I forget their name, something like 16 or 18 of them.
And this was a hill farm, you know.
Yeah, it was Crawford's, the, you know, small farmstead. Yeah, sort of thing we find in Scotland, I think. Or the Isles and so on.
Now, just to pick up, you used the Tommy gun in action. What did you think of the Tommy gun as a weapon?
Well, I didn't have any choice at the time, really. I mean, it was perfectly adequate to what I was concerned. I mean, one can evaluate it now in comparison to other weapons. I found it pretty reliable. It was probably heavy for its firepower. After all, it only fired 9mm. In effect, you know, revolver rounds. But I think they were the same rounds. But you know, it had a wooden butt, and it was a fairly heavy thing. But you know, I mean, it stood me in good stead. It only once jammed on me, and that was another. Well, a little bit later on, it jammed on me in a very, very critical situation.
We'll come to that. Now, in just generally in operations like this, what would you think was the relative role of officers, junior officers like yourself, and NCOs, either corporals, sergeants?
You mean as between junior officers and NCOs?
And generally, what do you think the difference between their roles in action was? Because some of the senior NCOs would be more experienced than you were.
Not in battle, though. They wouldn't be more experienced. They may have been. Some had been in North Africa. Well, I don't know. I mean, I can get a bit philosophical about this. But I mean, and of course, it depends so much on the individual. I mean, some officers might order a sergeant, they might make the plan, say, no, this is the plan. Sergeant, I'll do the covering fire from here, and you'll take the assault party around there. You know. But I mean, that was not my way. Rightly or wrongly, I led from the front. And, I mean,
so you'd leave the sergeant behind to do the covering fire?
No, that's right. I felt more confident. Well, I felt it was my duty to tell you the truth. You know, I really felt I couldn't. You know, I couldn't send somebody else there if I wasn't prepared to do it. So I always, in that way, I always led from the front.
So you saw it as the officer's job, or the junior's officer's job, to provide an example?
Absolutely, yes. And I well remember after the war, when I went to the Military Academy of Science, and the general, the commandant there, he interviewed every officer and asked them what they'd learnt in the war. And I said, because I think it was the only thing, you know, he said, what was the one dominant lesson you learned? And I said that the dominant lesson I learned were the prime role, you know, it's not quite the right adjective. But anyway, the totally determining role of the junior officer, the junior leader, the junior officer, what's the word I want, the, you know, the crucial role, if you like. That was the thing that I learned, because it was quite clear to me that unless platoon commanders led their platoons, you know, nothing happened. Anybody behind the orders. Now, occasionally, of course, you hear accounts of some more senior of a commander, to whether that because of the lack of leadership in, at their junior ranks, or whether because they themselves, you know, felt compelled to do it, would lead an attack. And I have in mind that unfortunate CO of the Italian in the Falklands who led an attack on the machine gun post, which he shouldn't have done, really. He got a VC for doing it because he was unlucky enough or unfortunate enough you know, to get hit. But, I mean, I've done that sort of thing a dozen of times and avoided getting hit. Because you don't get VC, you don't get hit.
Now, you captured this Croft, or yeah. Equivalent. Well, you don't know what it was called. Would it be on 0.430, do you think?
Let me look a minute, may I? Yes, well... Yes, I found the page in the regimental history now, and yes, it was, that must have been 0.430. I'd forgotten the sort of you know, the name of the particular feature we were on. That was one of these little knolls on the top of the mountain that I was telling you about.
Now, this was your final objective, was it, as far, or did you have to move further on beyond this Croft?
Well, I can't remember because in those circumstances, you know, the orders tended to change according to how the battle ebbed and flowed. My recollection is that we didn't move much beyond that at that time, and that then one of those very heavy artillery concentrations was brought down, and that was one of those that I said I wasn't very sure if it was when the shells were falling, if it was ours or theirs sort of thing. But certainly at about this time, you know, the enemy were clearly defeated and they withdrew. And the route up through the Calabrito Basin, which I mentioned in the first place, you know, was opened up. And so the feature was gained. And that was it really. So I don't think we put in many more assaults or anything like that at that time.
So the battalion had been very successful, this flank march and such.
Yes, indeed, totally successful, yes. I think that among the prisoners, I'm afraid that those prisoners, when we lined them up, you know, if any of them had any cameras or anything like that, which we didn't want to fall into the hands of the people guarding the prisoner of war camps behind, and we felt that we were more entitled to them. We helped ourselves, I have to say. That's slightly reprehensible in some ways, but among them was a camera, and I took some photos there and then. I just showed you a snap of that, and I think I was taken at that time, just after we'd, you know, because we then dug in somewhere near, you know, and retained and consolidated the position. That's what tended to happen, and with any luck, we had a brew up. You know, we made some tea.
Now, I wanted to ask about this sort of period. What sort of rations were you getting up? At this time, I mean, I know that was a particularly difficult point, but when the rations route had established itself,
we wouldn't have had any, of course, after that time. We just had
what you carried.
What we carried. Well, you know, I mean, as soon as we got in any sort of stable position, the quartermaster side really did miracles. I mean, we either took hardtack with us, you know, biscuits and bully beef, that sort of thing. At one time, I think later, we had American compo rations, and that was rather more varied. And there were things there, puddings and soups and things that one could eat on a that lady's spirit burner, sort of thing. Solid mess we used to have. But no, the cooks, as soon as we got any sort of, it was really, I think, very creditable. From the rear echelon, they would cook, you know, cook meals, would have stew. Stew and rice, you know, and it would be put in large containers, and containers of hot hot tea and so on. And they'd be brought up by transport to the sort of forward echelon, from the rear echelon. They'd be brought up to a forward echelon area. And then each company quartermaster sergeant, with, you know, with one or two regimental cooks and helpers, would bring the point to some. And then we would go half a section at a time with our mess tins. And we're given a hot meal.
It would still be hot after that move.
Yeah, because they're insulated containers, you see.
And were you getting, was that, you were getting enough to eat then?
Well, yes. I mean, I don't remember starving.
Did you get bored with monotony of, the necessary monotony, I presume?
Well, it was boring, but then, I mean, there was always something to do. One was either rest, sleeping, or else, you know, one was preparing for a patrol or recovering from a previous one.
What sort of day-to-day duties would you have as a second lieutenant, other than preparing for patrols, which we've looked at? But what other responsibilities would you have in the line?
Well, the most important thing, of course, is the security of your own defended locality. And, I mean, you've got, you're responsible for setting out the section post, the machine gun post, to deciding where the most likely lines, where the most likely threat is, and setting up your weapons and... and then deciding what regime of sentry go.
So when you set up the positions, did you find the theoretical training, the one with, you know, of finding a field of fire, which you were the only one to remember at one particular, did you find that useful? I mean, was that relevant?
Oh, yes, it was relevant. Then, of course, so much depends. I mean, the old training book cry, you know, it depends on the circumstances and the nature of the ground. And, I mean, for example, in the early part of the campaign in Italy, when we were in the lower things, we always dug. We dug sandals. But when we got into this mountainous area, you couldn't dig. And so you made sangers of stones. You just get a sense about it. It's where I was never attacked and overrun in all that time, although many patrols came up to. And I didn't have any of my soldiers. I can remember, I don't think I ever had anybody winkled out of my position, you know, and it's really just a question of having a sense of how to set up these interlocking things that are mutually supportive, and then having a good, responsible regime of keeping people on the alert all the time.
Now, how would you organise your sentry, or would you leave that to the sergeant?
Well, no, one would do it with him. I had Sergeant Jerrison at much of that time. He was a tremendous chap.
Jerrison?
Jerrison, yes, J-E-R-R-I-S-O-N. He was a splendid man and a very mature and, you know, sensible, stable Yorkshireman. The poor chap got killed, I'm afraid. Got killed in at Germano later on. But, and he was absolutely reliable. And he was a good deal older than I was, yes. And then my batman, whom I referred to before, Private Phillips, he was extremely reliable as well. And so what we used to do, I would give orders to what the strength of the sentry go was to be, whether or not it would be two men awake at a time, or whether it must be half a section, or whether the whole section would stand two. We always had a drill, dusk and dawn, it came from the First World War, really, I think, of stand two, and it was... A set time, I think it was set from battalion headquarters, that the whole battalion would stand there, and everybody stood to their posts and their weapons at dusk and at dawn, because those were theoretically the most likely times for an attack. And so, apart from stand two, when everybody was in position, then one would decide according to the threat and according to how tired people were, you see. And of course, you had to make sure you gave people enough rest, otherwise they'd fall asleep at the post. And of course, that's hopeless. And
you would see that as being part of your responsibility as an officer, rather than just the man's fault for falling asleep.
Yeah, absolutely, yes.
So
yes. You. I mean, chaps who fell asleep got a pretty severe rocket. They weren't shot anymore.
Would you actually court martial them?
No. I never did. I mean, you couldn't do that because people were.
But you were.
Fresh and blood. I'm sure that some people were more slack than others, and I mean, they had to be made aware of that.
But you recognised that there was a job to make sure the men didn't get too tired.
Absolutely, and also there was a job. Oh, I mean, I was very strict about checking on them. You just can't leave it to chance. And so what I used to do, you asked about the sergeant, and as I mentioned, Phillips, we three would take it in turns to go around the posts at, I forget now, it might have been an hourly interval, 2 hourly intervals or something like that. The telling us that we would go around all the posts and make sure that they were all alert.
How many men would there be to your sanger, roughly?
Well, two usually. In my case, Phillips and me. And, he was a private soldier, but he was so dependent. I could depend on him and going around the post.
Couldn't you promote him, or get him promoted?
Well,
just
no,
a
he
corporal?
Wasn't a promotable sort of chap, really.
Why not?
I could have given him a lance, I suppose he could have been given a lance for a strike, but...
Why wasn't he promotable?
Well, you know, although he was fairly reliable and responsible when told what to do, you know, he wasn't self-starting in the way that an NCO or and also he didn't easily exert authority over other people. But yet he was very, you know, he was very close to it, but he really didn't arise. He was quite content where he was.
So
and he did a brilliant job, quite honestly.
In the sangers, they'd have two men sangers. Would one of them always be awake, or would some sangers have a turn of being asleep?
Well, I think when you were on a lower scale of men, and say if you only had two men to a section awake, and there might be eight or something like that, depending on how many casualties you had in a section, then only the one person. We always manned the machine gun, you see. Whoever was on central would move them to the position where the machine gun was, and the others would be left.
Did you get enough sleep?
In the main, yes. I think I told you earlier when I was so dog-dog, I fell asleep and set my mattress on fire and went to sleep again before I put it out. And I remember one thing you were saying, you know, in this period, it must have been in this period, this long period, I think, between Voltaire and Camino, or it could have been Camino. I remember on one occasion we were in the line for 3 weeks. And I didn't have my boots off for 3 weeks. You know, all my clothing, and no question of going to bed at night. I think we may, I may be exaggerating, but we may have, I mean, certainly would have untied the bootlaces, and, you know.
Were you able to wash and shave, or make any pretense of washing and shaving?
Yes, I made more than a pretense. That was another thing I was very particular about. I always made my people wash and shave, even though they thought it was ridiculous sometimes. You know, they had no hot water. And, but if we were, when we'd been, say, dug in trenches, or night, we're going to move the next morning, or go on an advance or an attack, and I always insisted, you know, behind a hedge somewhere, and everybody got his nest in, put a drop of his water in it from the water bottle, and washed and shaved. And he had a tremendous morale boosting effect, I always felt.
Was there a problem with lice amongst the men or yourself?
I mean, we had powder, we had DDT powder, which we used if necessary. I mean, I dare say there were lice about, but I mean, a farmer that was some lice about, so we didn't know too much about it.
Would you, when you went round inspecting, would you inspect people's weapons to make sure they were in decent condition?
Absolutely, yes. And another very, very important thing was that you had to have a proper regime of weapon cleaning. You were asking earlier, you know, what you do during the day, and then you say, all right, you know, chaps not on standby clean their weapons. Or weapons to be cleaned, you know, half section at a time. You don't want to be caught with all your weapons stripped down when an attack comes in. But very important, because, you know, the small arms are particularly susceptible to malfunctioning due to mud, ingress of mud and quick and that sort of thing. And of course, they're the most likely to get the infection.
Any other responsibilities during a typical day when you're in the line?
Well, usual responsibilities, of course, are reporting back any information, keeping a lookout the whole time, reporting any movement soon.
Would you use your local? You had a radio, local radio. So you'd report to your company commander.
Yes.
Who'd be on the battalion net?
Yes.
You weren't on the battalion net,
no,
were you?
No, I wasn't on the battalion net, no. And I say, if we're in a fairly tight locality, I mean, by the way, one could send a runner, you know, with a little message, or else the radio net. And sometimes, if we were in a position any length of time, the signals ran out for your telephones, you know, which were better, but they were more secure, of course.
You had trouble on your first action with a radio not working. Did you have trouble at other times with that?
I think we must have done. They weren't very reliable at all. And I'm trying to think now, was the other thing we did, not only reported movement, but we had a drill for helping the Royal Artillery to bring down supporting fire, you know, attacking concentrations on enemy posts at least, possibly. Because we might be in a position we could see them where their observation posts couldn't see them. Giving the fire order.